Okay. All right. So where we left off last week, we were kind of setting everything up for Absalom's rebellion. And I think a helpful way to think about it, it's kind of ironic in a sad way, but in very different ways, we can say that David and Absalom do similar things in Perek Yud Gimel and Perek Yud Dalet. Perek Yud Gimel, when Absalom murdered Amnon, so he kind of gave himself permission to do what he wanted to do, right? We talked about how the moral fervor in defense of his sister really was underlying that was his own political ambitions, his own desire to be king, and his own realization that this is an opportunity to wipe out, to take out the crown prince and get what he's always wanted, which is from day one, Absalom has always wanted to be king. Well, the last week, it was much, much more benign, but David did something similar. Yoav, with the Ishat Koit, set up a situation that gave David the permission structure to do what he wanted to do, to think of bringing Absalom back not as a miscarriage of justice, but as rachamim for the victim, right? The whole story with the woman whose one son killed the other son, and the whole parallel to Absalom with Amnon, as the Abarbanel spelled out, presented David as the victim here and rachamim as the moral way to go. And all that to bring Absalom back into Yerushalayim. The irony is that by doing that, right, by really giving in to what he wants to bring his son back, but by giving in to that, David has planted the seeds for the rebellion, right? And something which we're going to see happen with Absalom, when Absalom is going to be undone, he's going to plant the seed. No, the Navi's going to say that ultimately it obviously comes from Ribbono Shel Olam, but that Absalom is going to bring about his own destruction. Well, here we had last week was David HaMelech himself planting the seeds for the own punishment that that he was promised in the aftermath of David and Bathsheba. So it's min hashamayim, but David can only look at his own actions as being responsible. You know, Avshalom is the most responsible, obviously, but David has his share of the blame. So this week we'll look at the next parak. I'm not sure we'll get all of it in. We'll try, but there's a lot to do, and some of it's really interesting and important. But the next, right, what we're up to next is the actual rebellion. So we load up the screen share, and before we dive into the psukim, I just want to point out. Oh, this is the wrong. I think this is the wrong thing, but okay, whatever. Yeah, this is. Oh, okay, it's the same sheet, so it's fine. Before we actually start, just notice how many times in the parak the word melech is used. And I think it's very, very important in terms of understanding that David is going to hit his low moment, right? Rock bottom is going to be this parak when David is going to be thrown out by his own son, as Nasan HaNavi had said, right? The person from his own loins, his own child, is going to throw him out into exile and try to get him killed. But specifically in David's low moment, as David always does, that is when he's going to rise to the occasion. And it specifically is when he is thrown out and someone else's own son usurps the throne that the Navi refers to him as Hamelech again and again and again. Just, what was it, 5, 10, 15, 20 times or something in this parak, again and again, the Navi calls David the Melech. What do you mean the Melech? We're going to see he's going to be barefoot. He's going to have a few straggling supporters with him. He's walking away from Yerushalayim, down into the desert, down into the empty wilderness, going to the same places where he had to hide as a fugitive, as he did when he was a young man running away from Shaul. Now, that was his father-in-law. Now he's an old man running away from his own son. But the Navi, again and again and again, refers to him here as the Melech, right? He's getting his punishment from Hashem for the averus he did, but David is going to be the exemplar of Kabbalas Adin, how to accept that. And when that happens, we're able to move past it. And already he's being called the Melech so many times. Okay, so just like a basic, orientation towards David in this parak. Now, we turn to Avshalom, and, where we last left off, Avshalom was, had hit a dead end, because his goal had been always, he always wanted to be king, and the goal had been to become king legally. He wanted to be the crown prince. So the first problem Avshalom had was, he wasn't the crown prince. The crown prince was Amnon. Okay, problem solved. Using the rape of Tamar, he's able to use that to justify killing Amnon. Amnon is out of the way. Then he has to run away to the north for a few years, but he's willing to wait. Eventually, he's brought back. And the hope is he is the oldest of the sons, right? We saw Barbanel in his mashal say, hey, just like the relatives are, you know, going to the woman and saying they want revenge, you know, they want Gol Hadam revenge because they really want to inherit the estate. The same exact thing is true with Avshalom. Barbanel said the other sons who are younger and not supposed to be in line for the throne want to make sure that Avshalom doesn't become king. So Avshalom is trying to restake his claim as crown prince. The problem is we saw at the end of last week when David finally granted the audience to Avshalom, because David is trying to walk a fine line. On the one hand, he's trying to have mercy and bring his son back. On the other hand, he realizes that what happened was wrong, and he's not willing to grant his son an audience. He's certainly not willing to anoint him as crown prince. Yoav finally intercedes. Avshalom has that meeting with the king. But as we saw, it was a very formal, kind of cool reception. And Avshalom realized at the end of last week that David is not going to anoint him as crown prince. David wants him home. He wants him in the palace. But that is not going to be the person who is going to be the king. So now my printer for some reason gone off here for a second, but hopefully it'll stop in a second. So what does Avshalom do next? So now right away Avshalom is going to change gears, and if he can't become David's crown prince, so he's going to try to replace him. And it's so interesting the strategy that he uses. As we'll see, he's really going to take a page out of the playbook of the original rebel we have in the history of Bnei Yisrael. He's going to take a page out of the book of Korach, but he's going to do Korach 1 better, like Korach 2.0. So let's see. So now Avshalom, as we know, he gets a chariot, he gets horses, 50 runners, right? So this very, very impressive appearance that Avshalom puts forward and sets up, between his long hair and his extraordinarily good looks and the chariot and the horses, he looks the part of the king. So step one, Avshalom wants to give off the image of royalty. He wants people to get used to the idea that this is, you know, a future king. David may have denied him the throne, but if he's not going to be the legal crown prince, he'll be the crown prince in the eyes of the people.
I'm just going to turn this off. Sorry. Why? Stop. Okay.
Yeah. So after that, right, Avshalom will now go to the gate of the city or the gate of the palace. He gets up early in the morning, right? The Nabi says, Hishkim Avshalom. We know what time is Man Kriya Shema these days? In the morning? Like 9:35 or something like that, right? So why Torah says, you know, Beshach Bechav Kumecha. You're supposed to say Shani, you get up in the morning. So, you know, I don't know, we don't get up at 9:30 in the morning. Why is Man Kriya Shema so late? That was the Mishnah saying Brachos. It's because the princes, right, the sons of the kings, they get up late. They don't have any work to do. They don't have to make a living. They're able to, you know, party all night, wake up as late in the morning as they want. Regular princes wake up late. But Avshalom, right, his Yetzer Hara never was pleasure. What he said, Amnon's Yetzer Hara was pleasure. Amnon was the one who's getting up late in the morning. Avshalom wants power, and he is totally willing to put in the effort. Hishkim Avshalom. He's going to get up early in the morning. He's going to stand by the gates. And then the Nabi says something very interesting. Anybody who had a court case, so he goes to the king for justice. And Avshalom would say to him, "May Eze Ir Ata, what city are you from? I'm from one of the Shvatim." Then Avshalom would say, "You're saying it's good. You have a good argument. But you're not going to get a good hearing over here." And then Avshalom would say, "Mi yisimeni shofet ba'aretz, I wish I could be the judge. Right? I wish people would come to me for justice and I would give him a good verdict." Okay. They have a krav ish l'shachavo slov v'shalach yasov v'hirsik lo v'nashak. And then the person would want to bow down to Avshalom, and instead Avshalom would kiss him. So let's break down and understand the brilliance of what Avshalom was able to do. When people talk about this, they normally just say, Avshalom was a populist, Avshalom was a demagogue, but let's actually understand what Avshalom does. Pasuk Aleph, Avshalom is setting himself up as a king. Everyone sees him as super impressive. Then all of a sudden, he's hanging out with the people. He's connecting to the people who want justice, and they want to bow down to him, and he's hugging and kissing them. Those seem like antithetical things, right? Is Avshalom the man of the people, or is Avshalom this royal, noble person of stature? Well, Avshalom realizes that both of these work hand in hand. It is much more impressive and much more moving when this distant, royal, impressive, beautiful, kingly person reaches out and talks to me and hugs me and kisses me, right? It is specifically the image of royalty that Avshalom creates in Pasuk Aleph, which makes his populist expression in the next few psukim all the more powerful. Now, Avshalom does a couple of other things as well. First of all, why is it so important that Avshalom says, what city are you from? What is going on with that exact piece of the dialogue? What are we, like small talk, Jewish geography? What exactly is going on over here? So the Malbim begins to unpack this for us. And the Malbim says, Omer HaMelech lo yishkod rak am, so for a second, tovah shivto, lo ayasa shivti Yisrael. Why is Avshalom focusing on what Shevet you're from? Does he say, what town are you from? And the guy says, I'm from such and such town in Shevet Ephraim. I'm from such and such town, I'm from Shevet Binyamin. And right away, Avshalom would say, puh, you're from Shevet Ephraim? You're from Shevet Binyamin? You are not going to get a good hearing from this king. Shomea ein lecha me'ez hamelech. In other words, Avshalom is zeroing in on the built-in tensions of royalty. There's going to be one Shevet which has the king. And that means you're going to have 11 Shvatim which have built-in resentment. So if Avshalom wants to foster rebellion, so first of all, he's going to present himself as a king, but also as a man of the people. And then he's going to nurture those, you have like a glowing coal and you can blow on it and build it up into a fire, much easier than starting a fire from scratch. So the people are from the other Shvatim and he's going to plug into that old lasting resentment. Okay, that's piece number one. Piece number two, though, and this is exactly the move we'll see that Korach does. This is absolutely brilliant. A couple of psukim, actually, right afterwards, what's going to happen? I want to come back to these psukim because there's a lot going on here. But we need to see one piece in the next couple of psukim. The Nevi tells us that that Avshalom turns to the king and he says, can I go to Chevron? Why is he going to go to Chevron? Okay, we'll talk about what happens here in a second. The key point is that Avshalom is going to go to Chevron and he's going to be crowned king in Chevron. Now, what is the significance of Chevron? Chevron is the capital city of Shevet Yehuda. That is where David was originally crowned as king of Shevet Yehuda after the death of Shaul. Chevron is far to the south. It's smack in the middle of the territory of Shevet Yehuda. And I think some of the modern Mefarshim say that what is Avshalom doing over here? Avshalom is plugging into the resentment of Shevet Yehuda. Shevet Yehuda looks at David and they say, David, you are supposed to be one of us. What are you doing moving your capital city from Hebron in Yehuda all the way up north to Yerushalayim on the very northern border between Yehuda and Binyamin? It's the not international city, but it's the inter-Shevet city, Yerushalayim. That's not what we signed up for. We want a partisan king. In Shmuel Aleph, Shaul was an explicitly partisan king. He talked to the people of Binyamin and he said, I'm benefiting you. Why are you supporting David? And Shaul's paranoid. Yehuda expects the perks of having their man be king. They look at David and they see him as bending over backwards the other 11 Shvatim. The other 11 Shvatim look at David and they see him as being a man of Shevet Yehuda. So what is Avshalom able to do? He's able to tie into the resentments of everybody, right? When you try to make everybody happy, and that's what you have to do as king. So sometimes that can work, and sometimes you can make nobody happy. And Avshalom is able to, you know, ride that wave of resentment. Why do I say this is related to Korach? The Netziv has an absolutely masterful analysis of Korach's rebellion. The Netziv says, let's think for a second. Who was on Korach's side, right? So we have Dasan and Aviram. And we know what they stand for. We know their values. We know what they want. They want to go back to Mitzrayim. Then we also have these 250 people who want to be the Kohen Gadol and are yearning to burn Ketores. You know, Dasan and Aviram, they don't want a Kohen Gadol. I mean, they don't want to serve Hashem. They want to go back to Mitzrayim. So what relationship do any of these people have with each other? And then Netziv explains that there were two totally different groups of people with two totally different fields of resentment towards Moshe and Aaron. And the evil genius of Korach is that he's able to forge a coalition of people where the only thing they have in common is that they're angry with Moshe and Aaron. You have the materialist Dasan and Aviram side, who is resentment of Tarag Mitzvos and Eretz Yisrael, the whole program Moshe and Aaron stand for, and they just want to go back to a life of imagined luxury in Mitzrayim. And then you have the people, the Kol Ha'eda Kulam Kedoshim people, the people who look at the Kahuna and they say, hey, every day I'm a spiritual person. I want to serve in the Mishkan. Why is Avodah only reserved for Aaron Kohen and his sons? I want to be a Kohen. I want to be a Kohen Gadol. I want more Avodah Hashem in my life. Two totally opposite groups of people. The brilliance of Korach is he's able to realize that, right, when you're angry and resentful, so you can very easily be manipulated into kind of doing anything that services the cause of your resentment and your anger. So Korach is able to forge this coalition of two fundamentally different groups. And think about it, right? They have two fundamentally different punishments. One group, the Dasan and Aviram crew, gets swallowed up into the earth because that's the punishment for their gross materialism. And then the Ketores group gets burned by fire from Shemayim because they had much more spiritual aspirations. So the exact same thing is being done here by Avshalom, where he's picking up on the latent resentments that the people have, and he's creating a united coalition out of it. Now, good luck to Avshalom, you know, if the rebellion was successful, how could he balance the different parts of this coalition he's putting together once the uniting factor they had, which was resentment against David, goes away? Well, that's going to be a challenge that Avshalom never has to deal with because he's going to fail. But that is what he's doing, creating this really, you know, this image of royalty, but the populace. And he, you know, to one group, he's the man of the other Shvatim, but he's also the man of Sheva Yehuda. There's one last piece we have to appreciate as well. Avshalom goes to the people specifically when they're coming for justice, right? And the question is, 50% of people who come for a court case should win, and 50% who come from a court case should lose. So if Avshalom's strategy is to find the resentment of the people who come to the palace to get a ruling, that's not necessarily the greatest strategy, right? Because, you know, if your electoral strategy has you winning a maximum of 50% of the vote, it's not going to do you very well. You know, that's not a winning strategy. So how exactly is this going to work for Avshalom? How is this going to indeed help him, as the Navi says, with Kol Ha'ish, with all the people who are coming? So there are a couple of different suggestions. This is really something that the more modern Mefarshim have taken up. I think the most compelling analysis is a suggestion from Rav Meidan, because it fits in with what we saw from the previous parak. And Rav Meidan suggests that the reason why everyone is upset is because David, especially in the aftermath of Uriah and Bathsheba, where he feels totally paralyzed and he feels totally hypocritical sitting as a judge after having done what he did, whatever exactly was that he did. There is an excess of rachamim, an excess of compromise, and a failure to really pursue justice in David's court. That's the suggestion he makes. And there's good reason to think so, because that is exactly what we saw last week, right? That was exactly what happened in the episode of the Ishat Kohet, who comes to the king for a ruling of Rachamim. We saw David fail to pursue justice after Amnon raped Tamar, and then after Avshalom murdered Amnon. We shouldn't think, you know, it doesn't only happen with the family. Inevitably, that's going to bleed over into his other, into his day job as a judge. The Gemara in Sanhedrin talks about exactly this phenomenon. Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Yossi Lili Omer, Aser Livtsoa. It is prohibited to pursue compromise in a bezin. Anybody who does so, that's a sin. Anybody who blesses the compromiser, the person who compromises and the person who blesses him is despised by Hashem. We need to have, right, the justice pierce the mountain. Now, the Gemara, we should read two lines of Gemara because we have to understand that this is sophisticated. The odds are, if someone has a din Torah and go to the CRC, so the initial pursuit they're going to have, they're going to try for pshara. They're going to try for arbitration and compromise. Why are they going to do so? Well, the Gemara continues. So Gemara says, V'chein Moshe haya omer yikov adin ha-sahar. The model of Moshe Rabbeinu was pure justice. Let the law pierce the mountain. Aval Aaron, ohev shalom, rodev shalom, umesim shalom, ben adam l'chaveiro. Right? The other model was the model of Aaron HaKohen, the model of peace and reconciliation. Shem our Torah samas haisu v'fiyo v'avlo nintu v'sfasov v'shalom v'mishra halachiti v'rabim heishiv me'avon. Aaron was the one who was able to bring people together and conciliate. So we have three models, right? Compromise, which is cursed. And then we have Moshe's justice and Aaron's shalom. So it's very tricky as a judge to know when is this illegal compromise and when is this the celebrated Aaron HaKohen model. Right, there's a whole, there's a whole huge sugya. But when it gets to a situation, what is the bitsia? What is the prohibited arbitration over here? It's when what's happening is there's so much compromise that there's just a total undermining of the system. Right? If you know that no one is ever going to really be called to account, the other person is always going to be given the slack. You can have the cases which are so cut and dry. The person caused me $100 of damage. I have the bill from the insurance company, right? It's straightforward. Give me $100. Just, I need the compensation. And then you go to the judge. Well, extenuating factors, he's had a hard day. Can we go for 50? Sometimes you're not supposed to negotiate, right? What the parameters of that are can be very complicated. But when you have a situation where all you have is compromise, then everything, right? Then the whole system is going to fall apart. And what are you going to have? You're going to have a system where nobody is happy. Everyone's coming for justice, but no one's happy because there's a sense that it's just the system is collapsing. That's the suggestion of Meidan Beis. I think it's a very compelling one, in light of David's previous behavior. So Avshalom then is picking up on a lot of things, a lot of the undercurrents of existing frustration that Bnei Yisrael have. And as we've seen many times, the master manipulator that he is manipulating them towards his own end. Okay, now one last thing. I'm sorry this is taking so long, but it's just there's a ton going on in these psukim. We have to really plow through them carefully. One last thing that's really striking for us to note over here, and this is going to be absolutely essential for setting up Avshalom's rebellion. What Avshalom says in Pasuk Dalet is absolutely astonishing. Right. What did Avshalom say? You remember Avshalom? Me yisimeni shofet ba'aretz. I wish I was the judge. Ve'alai yavo kol ish asher yelo reba mishpat. And everyone would come to me who had a court case. So what's Avshalom saying? Right. We don't even have to read between the lines. What's he virtually openly declaring? Avshalom is basically telling everybody who comes to the palace, I wish that I was king. If I was the judge, come on, who's the shofet? The shofet is the melech. He's basically saying, if I was the king, everything would be better. Avshalom, subtlety is never Avshalom's strong suit. He has a problem with Yoav last week, lights his field on fire. Right? He has a problem with Amnon, gets his men to kill him. He can be patient, he can be conniving, he can be manipulative. Avshalom doesn't do subtle. He's has the nerve somehow to openly declare that he wants to be king. And I think this is very important for David's reaction to his rebellion, is that it's an open secret. It's an open secret that that Avshalom wants to be king. I mean, come on. He has a chariot and horses and 50 men riding before him. And he's openly saying, I wish me yisimini shofet ha'aretz. Avshalom thinks, and he thinks correctly, that he doesn't need to conceal or hide his ambitions to take over the throne. And he's right, because David doesn't do anything. David knows exactly what's happening, but David never does anything to Avshalom. Okay, so Avshalom now turns to David, and he says, I want to go to Hebron. Right, he says, I took a neder when I was in exile that if Hashem would bring me back, so from. It's really inspiring. The inspiring of Shalom's from, right? Look what he says. He drops Hashem's name three times in these couple of psukim. I need to double check. I'm not sure if there's anywhere else where Shalom uses the Shem Hashem. But, you know, it's like Chazal say with Yitzchak and Esav, right? You know, you can tell what the person wants to hear. And Shem Hashem is something which is Shagarathiv of David, for sure. So Avshalom says, you know, I want to make my neder made to Hashem, and I swore when I was in exile in Geshur, if Hashem brings me back, I'll serve Hashem. I want to bring karbanos, right? Really, very, very from. So Avshalom is manipulating his father, taking advantage of his father's from. But there's a more pernicious piece to this as well, which is Avshalom is drawing on a very clear parallel from Sefer Bereishis. You know, we know somebody who was in exile. And as he goes into exile, promises that if Hashem brings me back to this place, that I will bring karbanos. That's of course Yaakov Avinu as he goes out towards Laban. So you know Yaakov is really the model in so many ways, as we've seen, we'll continue to see, for David HaMelech. David's life parallels that of Yaakov in so many different ways, and Avshalom seizes on this, and Avshalom positions himself as another Yaakov Avinu character. Another Yaakovian personality. You know, I promised Hashem that if I could ever get back to Hebron, probably saying Hebron because that's where he was born. Avshalom was born at Hebron. If Hashem brings me back to Eretz Yisrael, to the land of my birth, I'll give karbanos, I'll serve. Right? Just, you know, it's not just lies and manipulation, but the perversity, the religious perversity, to use religion and karbanos and David's values and to mention Hashem's name, Yudke Vavke, three times for his own selfish ambitions. You know, that tells us once again all we need to know about Avshalom. I think consistently we're going to see Avshalom is somebody who really, there are no redeeming features, you know, in Avshalom, which is a bit of controversial. As we go forward, we'll see some of Parashim see some good in Avshalom. I think the Pesukim just present him as the ultimate Ben Sora Mora at every turn. You know, Avshalom has really nothing, so much talent, immense talent, but nothing when it comes to values. And yet, you know, father for his child, and yet David is able to, you know, have the care for him that he does. Okay, so king tells him, go ahead, go to Hebron. Fine. Okay, move down a little bit. And then Avshalom is sending Meraglim to the holy. So, right, there's going to be a coup. We're going to go to Hebron. And he sends spies to all of Israel, saying, when you hear the shofar, so you're going to announce that Avshalom is the king in Hebron. Now we need to wonder. David has very good intelligence. We're going to see already in this, later on in this parak, David is an extraordinary, you know, when it comes to military intelligence and a spy network, David really knows what he's doing. Can it be, I'm just going to talk while I get my computer charger, that David would, you know, have no clue at all what's going on. This could all happen totally under David's nose, and he just misses everything. A little bit doubtful. So Avshalom sends Achitophel, who was David's advisor. Okay, and the Kesher is amidst, the conspiracy is strong, the people are with Avshalom. And come on, there's like a national gathering with Avshalom, and we're supposed to believe that David doesn't know anything about it at all. And they announce that Avshalom is going to be the king. And then what's David's reaction? Okay, David is told that all of Israel is following Avshalom. What does David say right away? Kumu v'nivracha. We need to get up and run. Ki lo si'alenu plitav ne Avshalom. We're not going to have any escape from Avshalom. Maru l'lachas peni meher v'yisiganu v'idiach alenu sarah v'yipayir l'fichara. So David has a lot of words right there. And there's a lot of action. Right? He says, how many times? Kumu v'nivracha. Get up, we got to run. We're not going to have any escape. Maharu l'lachas. Right? Get fast. We need to go. So David immediately diagnoses the situation and he says, we need to get out of here. There's no sense of surprise. There's no sense of shock. It's almost like David has seen this coming the whole time. And that's the impression we get from the Navi. It's not secret. Avshalom was never subtle. David mostly saw what he was up to. He knows that he wants to be king. He knows that he wants to take over. And once it happens, then David shifts into movement. Now, what's important, though, is that David didn't do anything until this point, right? So why not? If Avshalom was clear in his intentions, and yet David didn't do anything, now all of a sudden, one pasuk, David shifts into action. We got to move. We got to go. Let's get out of here. Nothing until then. Perek Yud Gimel. Amnon, nothing. Perek Yud Dalet, Avshalom, nothing. Perek Tzvav, Avshalom, becoming more and more powerful. Nothing. Nothing, 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 nothing from David. Paralysis the whole way through until now. Why? The reason is very simple. Because David knows, no one else knows this. No one else was in the room with David and Nasan. But David knows exactly what's happening to him and why. He knows what his sin was. He knows that he feels totally morally compromised. And he knows that what's happening is happening from Ribbono Shel Olam. He knows what Nasan told him about, that the evil is going to come from your own loins. So it paralyzes him. He just accepts it. There's nothing. He feels like there's nothing for him to do. It's coming from a higher place, and he's just accepting it. And once it finally happens, Once the boom is finally lowered, it finally comes, you almost get a sense of relief from David HaMelech. Now it's finally come. The punishment is finally here. Now it's like he's like a fish back in water. Okay, I was waiting for this to happen. Now I know we need to go. Kumu v'nivracha. I know exactly who Avshalom is. He has no illusions about his own son. He knows what he will do. He knows that his son is a man of violence. As we're going to see in the next couple of prakim, it's going to be very, very important. Avshalom is a bloodthirsty person, and David knows that. He says, we need to evacuate the city as quickly as we can because he'll destroy the whole city if I'm not here. David's servants are surprised by this. They say, really? Right? If you say so, we think it's a little bit much to evacuate Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is a very strong military position. But David has the force of will, and all of a sudden now, out of nowhere, he's able to impose that on them and say, no, I know we need to do, we need to get out of here. And we'll close with this. We'll look next week at as David continues on his way out of Yerushalayim, but the Navi closes with the Melech v'chol beiso biragla. They're all leaving Yerushalayim, except for the 10 Pilag Shim, who David leaves behind, and that's going to be a tragedy next in the next parak. But what does this mean, Biraglav? So it seems to mean they just followed David. But Ralbag suggests, and this is going to be clear later on in the parak, that they are specifically walking on their feet. David doesn't have a chariot, he doesn't have a donkey, he doesn't have a horse, he's walking on his feet. And we have here this massive contrast between David and Avshalom. Avshalom was the one who was setting himself up as the image of royalty, galloping around on the horses and the chariots and the runners. David doesn't look at all like a king. He's on foot. He's being thrown out of his capital city. He has a few people supporting him and no real supplies and no army and no hope. But this gets us back to the original core idea in Sefer, right? The original mistake that Shmuel made when he looked at Shaul, and he looked at David, and he looked at David's brothers. And that a melech, it's not about the externals. Royalty is not about the externals. Want to know who looks like a king? Shaul, tallest man in Israel, looks like a king. Avshalom, most beautiful man, in Israel looks like a king. But that has nothing to do with the king, right? Vayetzei hamelech b'chol beiso b'raglav. David can be on foot, he can be exiled, but he in this perek is the melech, right? He is the king. He's accepting the punishment for what happened long ago, and that is how he's going to be able to get through this. So it seems like he's at the low point, but it is specifically, right, at David's real rock bottom. And now he's being thrown out by his own son that we are going to begin to see, you know, even next week, even in this parak, while he's still leaving Yerushalayim, we're beginning to see that the, you know, like it's darkest before the dawn and the glimmers of light are coming through. Okay, so we'll stop now because I can't find my computer charger and I think this will die in any second. So thanks everyone for coming, and Ritz Hashem, looking forward to more next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.